Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, when a photographer created controversial images of her daughter, she wasn't trying to stir up controversy at all.
And a Diné activist uses uranium glass to tell the devastating story of uranium mines on the Navajo Nation. But first, picture this, Botticelli's Birth of Venus. But instead of the goddess rising out of a seashell in the ocean, it's a plastic shell in a Phoenix backyard. Venus is a queer woman who's tattooed and wearing stilettos. The blanket her angel is throwing over her is a serape. That's what the iconic work looks like through the eyes of Phoenix photographer and artist Omar Soto. It's part of their series, Mediums of Hope. Other photographs in the series include Soto's interpretation of the Archangel Michael defeating Satan. Michael is draped in a Mexican flag. And a gender-bending Venus of Urbino. It's just the kind of subversive subject matter that Soto, who is non-binary, likes to feature in their work. But it's mostly meant to be uplifting. I sat down with Soto in our studios this past July to talk more about how a high school photography class turned into a career and why they treat digital photography like the film they learned first.
I still have my film camera. I love it. And I kind of treat digital like it's film. You know, I and that's why I do everything practical, because I want to be able to capture everything in camera and have like the most minimal of any type of editing as possible.
Right. So you're shooting digital photography, but almost treating it like film, because the scenes that you set up are what you see in the photo. Like you said, you maybe will erase like a line of a string or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
But for the most part, what you're shooting is what you're getting. Talk a little bit about just the process, the setup that might go into something like this, because these are intricately costumed. There's lots of props. Yeah. There's bubbles in one of these photos. How do you do this?
You know what? I guess it really starts with research, of course, looking into these paintings and these iconic images that we grew up with. You know, the Venus I'd seen everywhere. There's religious iconography that I grew up with, you know, growing up as a Catholic. And, you know, I'll research the artist. I'll see what their lives were about, what they're about, you know, what their issues were. You know, I just really like to deep dive. And if the image just kind of calls to me, then I'll look up the context of the painting as well. And, you know, there's so many little details that go into them, and it reflects when they lived. And yeah, you know what? Then I start doing kind of some soul searching, I guess. I start looking into my own life and how I could relate to this, or people that I know, and how I would think that they could relate to it. And then I start thinking about setting where I could have it at. And I guess I kind of like the limitations of the real world, like, because it kind of pushes you to like innovate and try new things.
So you're not recreating these in studios that look just like the originals, right? Like
no.
The Birth of Venus painting, you're doing a photo of that painting, and it's in like a, it looks like a backyard. There's a cinder block wall, right?
Yeah, it was definitely my friend's grandma's backyard.
There you go.
So shout out to her.
Talk about that photo in particular, based on the famous painting, right? Because it's a great example of what you do. You can tell immediately what it is that you're doing and what the image is supposed to reflect. Yeah. But it's very subversive. You're using queer models, lots of people of color.
Yes.
Why?
You know what? Because I am both queer and a person of color, and I'm an immigrant. And the theme of the series is, you know, these mediums of hope, you know, and what I mean by that is that there's different mediums that have been used throughout just history, you know, like the caveman scratching onto the wall or just painting, and then photography came along. And, you know, we all kind of project our hopes and dreams onto these images. Even when you're religious, you do, you know, you pray directly to the photo of the Virgen. And I do end up casting people of color because of the fact that, you know, we looked at these images and they were so iconic, but they were never created by us or for us. You know, they're usually very straight and very white. And even when you're Mexican and growing up Catholic, you know, there's all this imagery of people that don't necessarily reflect your life. And I really wanted that for ourselves. I wanted to reclaim it. I wanted to show that, you know, we have power to just look really resilient in these images. And, you know, the settings are always really based in places that I grew up. Space is really important. You know, it can limit you depending on where you grew up, or it can help you excel. And these spaces aren't always seen as beautiful. But I wanted to show that even in a place like this, you could still, you could still thrive. You could still chase your dreams, that you could really make things happen for yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to create it. I wanted to have community and to show us and center us, basically.
Right, because it's a commentary in itself, right?
Yes.
Like the painter or the photographer putting a subject in the center of the painting.
Yeah.
That's what beauty is, right? Like,
exactly.
That's what you're saying with that, right?
Yeah.
So you're recentering who is considered beautiful.
Exactly. And it's almost like I'm not asking, I'm just taking it for my own, and we're just going to rock out like that.
Let me ask you about your own identity and how that plays into this. You identify as non-binary.
Yes.
Has that always been the case for you?
It was always a feeling that I had that, you know, I never felt completely comfortable as male, but I also didn't feel completely comfortable as woman because I don't really see myself as either. And I guess the way that a religious person could say that, you know, you're a spirit having a human experience, I guess I kind of see it in that way because I never worry about gender, really, you know, in respects to everybody and what they identify as. You know, I just feel like I'm just me. I'm just Omar. And non-binary kind of fits that. And, you know, growing up as an immigrant, I had an immigrant upbringing and community. But the thing is, they didn't really see me as one of them either. So it's like when we were being shunned by all these different laws and stuff like SB 1070 and, you know, things that would push a community together. I also felt very outed from that community, so I felt really isolated.
So that's interesting because you're saying you felt othered and then othered again, right?
So
is that what you're trying to remedy here by kind of creating or celebrating this community that probably feels the same way?
Yeah, it literally is. And it's even me putting myself into it. And in these images, you know, they're searching for hope and a better day. And, you know, I just feel like if you just try, at least, I just want to know that I tried, you know. So yes, I would say that I do this for those that have felt other than for myself. And it's kind of a healing process. It's very cathartic, I guess, to be able to put my hopes and dreams into these images and make my own reality, I guess. And honestly, it's manifested into my own reality. So yeah, it's really cool.
Manifested into your own reality.
Yeah.
That's lovely. Let me ask you lastly about reaction to this, right? Like, I mean, do you get pushback? Are people offended by this sometimes? Because you'll do lots of, as you mentioned, like Catholic religious imagery, but in this kind of subversive way.
Yes.
What do people say?
Well, you know what? Yes. It's definitely a varied reaction. You know, especially when I was first starting with the series and I was looking for locations, you know, I wanted to use locations that were, I guess, iconic and to me in places I grew up. And, you know, either people really like it or they really hate it. And, you know, and I mean, I'm cool with the discourse, but, you know, sometimes people feel like, yeah, it's disrespectful. But then I guess I have to question, well, why would it be disrespectful that a queer person or a Black person is centered in that image? You know, and it's not really even a commentary on religion. It's just about the symbolism of religion and how we put our hopes and dreams into that. And I just wanted that symbolism for myself and for the series. Honestly, the discourse is kind of cool that people have that because, you know, I guess that means that it's thought-provoking enough without disrespecting anybody. I just wanted to center, you know, brown and queer and Black people.
Okay. We'll leave it there. That is Omar Soto joining us, photographer and recipient of the 2024 Sally and Richard Lehman Emerging Artist Award from the Phoenix Art Museum. Omar, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
ASU professor Betsy Schneider is an artist and a filmmaker, and she has a lot of personal experience with censorship. Back in the 90s, when her daughter was born, Betsy and her then-husband started a daily photography project. Twice a day, they took a picture of their daughter. Their daughter was nude in the images, and over the years, Betsy came to see the photographs as a kind of document of human development. She began showing the photographs as a series she called Quotidian. And right away, it was controversial. As Betsy told me last July, over the years, the Quotidian series has been an evolving lens for her to understand her life as an artist and how people react to her art.
I was so proud. I had this stack of, you know, machine prints, and I went to just like a sharing session, like a critique session. And a woman, she's like, you're going to have trouble with this. And I mean, I knew, you know, certain pictures of children provoked people in certain ways. I mean, I also grew up in the 70s and I was married to a Scandinavian. So childhood nudity also was like, had been, and photography had been really like normalized. So I was really shocked.
Can I just ask, I mean, do I take that correctly to say that the goal for you in making these photographs was not to be provocative?
Yeah, no, you know, a lot of it was about, I mean, really basic, like, wow, look how much a baby changes.
So you do this showing of the work in progress version of Quotidian, and you get this feedback that I think you said the woman says,
yeah,
you're going to have trouble.
Yeah. And then in 2004, it was actually removed from a show in London.
Were you told it was going to be removed?
Yeah. It was a weird situation where the curator was a friend of mine. Her dad was taking pictures of the installation. Somebody saw a man taking pictures of a naked child, and they reported it to the director, and the director's like, that work needs to be taken down.
Can I just ask, was the man punished for taking the photographs?
No, I mean, he was taking installation shots for the artists, right?
The pictures were like,
it wasn't even genuinely somebody with prurient interest photographing. I mean, that brings up a whole other level of policing, right? Assuming the worst intent when somebody looks at something. The Kohler Center wasn't even that they thought it was genuinely problematic. It was that they thought other people were going to think it was problematic.
That's interesting. So we should just say the Kohler Center is an art center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Quotidian was ultimately exhibited.
So in 2012, it was part of a larger show at the Kohler Center. It got taken down from the Kohler Center. And just for context, there were some other artists, including Catherine Opie and Ryan McGinley, who are known for making work that pushes boundaries, and specifically in relation to the body. So it was kind of ironic, I think, that we're more threatened by the children's body than the adult body.
And to be clear, their work was not taken down.
No, their work was not taken down. The show actually went on to two other venues, including one at the Weatherspoon in North Carolina and then the Addison in Andover, Massachusetts. And they included my work, but they contextualized it. My daughter wrote a little text. She was like, it's just normal. It's just like brushing your teeth. So they included this text and they kind of proactively created a space. Like, look, we know some people might have issues with this. Let's talk about it.
Can I ask, what is your daughter's name?
Madeline.
Madeline. How does Madeline feel about all this, looking back on it?
So maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I had her come into a class that I was teaching, and one of the students asked her about the work. And I said, you know, do you want it to be shown? And she said, yeah. She's like, we worked really hard on that. And I mean, this is 25-year-old, you know, at this point, you know, and I was like, wow. I'd always been nervous about calling it a collaboration with her because, you know, an infant is not a collaborator, you know,
and they can't consent.
Exactly.
Well, can I ask you, Betsy, there must have come a moment where she was of an age where you could show her the work for the first time and she would have some understanding of what it was.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment and how it went?
So I actually made a video of her looking at it, but by then she was 8. And, you know, in this particular video, she's like, well, it's important to you. It's your art. And the problematic nature of her mom interviewing her about something that related to her mom, notwithstanding,
that
was definitely a moment where I was like, she understands that this is something that we're doing together, but that it's ultimately my thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go to shows, faculty shows where my work would be up. And she didn't like being the center of attention. She's like, it's not about me. We as adults are like, oh, you're naked and you're in public. And her interpretation was like, no, pictures are pictures. I have a whole nother life.
There is this way in which art being censored or generating controversy, even if it's not censored, weirdly attracts more attention to the art.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What's your thought on that piece of all this?
Personally, I've never been able to spin that into gold. I've never been able to be one of those people that took controversy and advanced my career. So
sure.
That's answer number one. But uh-huh. I mean, I think things are scarier now in ways, personally, they weren't as scary 20 years ago. And
can you say more about the scariness? What do you mean?
I mean, obviously museums are canceling shows about things.
Uh-huh.
It feels like there's a lot more fear. It's also our job as artists to keep making stuff. We can't expect to be comfortable all the time. Like when I was making that work, I was so confident. I was like, I'm not hurting my kids. I'm making art. It's important art. And I am going to stand behind it. And maybe I'll lose my job. And maybe this will happen. But I stand behind my work.
But let me go back to what you said a moment ago, Betsy, about how maybe, you know, artists need to be aware that they're not always going to be comfortable. It also feels like implicit in what you're saying is that consumers of art need to have an expectation that they're not always going to be comfortable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I heard something recently that freedom and comfort are not the same thing. I mean, I think it's interesting, too, is that, you know, there's been a lot of push towards, well, there was until recently, like towards, you know, identity-driven art. And on one hand was really interesting and good and positive, but it also started to become something that we became comfortable with, the ways that certain groups were portrayed and standing behind certain artists who we felt like made work that reflected our own kind of positive or progressive views of the world. And a lot of us started to get away from and forget that one of the functions of art is to push us towards things that are scary and uncomfortable. And those may be for people who are left-leaning, they may be right-leaning things, or they may be things that don't go left and right and mm-hmm. confuse us a little bit and put us in this ambivalent or ambiguous place.
Can I ask you as a last question, and this is a hypothetical, but let's say that you had completed the work on Quotidian or were in the midst of it, and your daughter had come to you and said, I actually am not comfortable with this being shown, or I don't feel good about the idea of people seeing me this way. How do you think that would have impacted your perspective on this?
Yeah. I mean, I would like to believe I was the kind of person who would say, okay. Mm-hmm. What I probably would have done was find a way to keep doing it and wait until she got to be older and have a conversation. And there's a self-centered nature to art. And I do think that making art out of your own life can be really complicated. It's part of what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
That's an imperfect answer.
It's maybe not a comfortable answer, but it is the answer.
Yeah.
Well, Betsy Schneider is...
Yeah, thank you.
A photographer and a filmmaker. And Betsy, thank you for this uncomfortable but important conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, uranium glass has a beautiful green glow to it. But for one artist, the glass reminds her of the negative effects of uranium mines that have rippled across the Navajo Nation for decades.
I don't have that opportunity to be ignorant to it because I know what lies behind that ethereal glow.
A Diné activist on raising awareness by using uranium glass in her art. But first...
Phoenix may be one of the fastest growing places in the country, but it's also incredibly transient. As we documented in our series Exit Interview, lots of people who make their mark on the Valley of the Sun leave. They hit a ceiling or head off for the big time. We've interviewed chefs whose critically acclaimed restaurants couldn't make it here, writers who went to the Ivy League, musicians who left for Nashville, and a South Phoenix born and raised artist who found her voice in Europe.
When I moved to Germany, I was set on, I am not going back to America. I'll go back for work, but I am living in Europe for the rest of my life.
That's Antoinette Cauley. You might know her from her basketball court-sized mural for the Phoenix Mercury, or her remarkable portraits of young Black girls decked out in hood culture, or her nine-story-high mural of Black writer and activist James Baldwin, which overlooks Roosevelt Row. She made a name for herself in Phoenix. But not too long ago, as the pandemic took hold and then George Floyd's murder rocked America, she told me she had to get out. She took a residency in Berlin and left. It was a professional boon. In her 2022 exit interview, she told me she knew becoming international would up her value as an artist. But her mental health suffered during Germany's cold, dark winters, and she fell in love with someone back home.
It took me about a year, and my boyfriend, made it very clear, if you don't want to come back, we will figure it out. We'll make it work. He never once asked me to come back, but he did let me know, you know, of course I want to be with you.
And at the same time, in a short few years, she says Phoenix had changed too.
The opportunities are in abundance now. It's insane how much the art community, the community in general, has grown.
Yeah.
And so I'm bombarded with just different things and having to turn things down, and it's been a whirlwind.
A very different position to be in.
Yeah.
So she's back. And ready to be a voice for Phoenix and the growing community of Black artists here.
I remember maybe like 15 years ago when I first was like, okay, maybe I should do this art thing. Mm-hmm. And went and had lunch with one of my good friends, Chris Rhymes. He's also a Black artist. He's phenomenal. And I remember we had lunch together and we were like, dude, we are the only Black artists we know. We got to stick together.
Yeah.
And now it's like I keep a roster for different events and things so I can email people. And there's like 60 names I have, you know, and growing.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you were part of the catalyst for that?
Definitely. I don't think I necessarily tried to be. Mm-hmm. But I think that just through following my purpose and listening to my calling that I became a pillar of sorts within the Black arts community. Yeah. And help other artists see what's possible. And also, I've intentionally tried to create a blueprint for mm-hmm. how you can build like an independent art career.
So it sounds like, and I remember talking to you about this when you were in Berlin, you really, like, something drew you there and something felt free there. You felt like you were free maybe of some of the discrimination, some of the things that you felt held you back or were kind of suffocating you in America as a Black person here.
Definitely. I felt free for the first time, and it was tied into safety and interactions with the police and not being harassed. I want to point out that, like, racism exists everywhere. Discrimination exists everywhere. Sexism, all that stuff, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. But it looked a lot different and was a lot less in Germany. Walking around, you're not getting followed in grocery stores, or if you carry your backpack in there, it's normal, you know, they don't think you're gonna like steal or whatever. They're just not as bothered, I guess. It's like every time I would land at the airport in Phoenix, it's like I could just smell the racism everywhere. And you know, you get looks here where you can tell people are passing judgment, or I've had so many experiences like that, and I didn't experience that in Germany. It just felt, I don't know how to explain it. It was just free.
Yeah.
And every flight home, I would cry because I'm like, my family's never going to know what it feels like to be free because they just don't have the access for this stuff. Mm. So it was a painful experience. But I'm glad I experienced it so I can encourage other people to try, you know, try to get out of here.
Which, you know, is interesting because, of course, now you're back.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to talk about something you said there that I think comes up a lot with people who leave and come back to Phoenix. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you were a failure in doing that?
100%. It was the most, not in hindsight, I'm like, wow, that was crazy to feel that way. But I remember thinking like, wow, I did this big thing. I accomplished this huge dream. If I, you know, quote unquote, abandoned that, does that mean I failed? And every time I would ask, you know, talk to my friends or my therapist about it, I would just break down into tears. And I guess I didn't realize, like, how much at the time, how much of my own, like, internalized self-worth was in the fact that I was able to move mm-hmm. to Europe and do it on my own and do all these things. And I think really what it was is I would have felt sort of that unworthiness or not being good enough if I had left that behind, which is not true by any means. No matter what, I did it, you know, did something that most people would be too afraid to even approach, you know. So that was a huge feeling I grappled with that took me about like a year to get to the point that I was like, I'm not a failure if I come home. Mm-hmm. I succeeded no matter what.
So let me ask you about your art in all of this. What did your 3 years in Berlin do for your practice, your art? What has coming back done for it?
Oh, man. Berlin changed everything. Mm-hmm. Berlin made me confront a lot of thoughts, feelings, and ideas I had about myself, about my community, about my country. You know, I went to Berlin for an artist residency, and so I took that time to really explore and experiment. And I realized what I was actually speaking to in my work. One thing I've always been drawn to is like Black American hood culture. Mm-hmm. I grew up listening to gangster rap. You know, my dad had like an old Impala with like Dayton rims on it and sound systems. And I'm used to that culture. It feels nostalgic. It feels comfortable. It feels like home. So I paint about that a lot. But while I was in Germany, I really explored, like, I was able to contrast the level of freedom I saw in one country versus the other one. And I just thought, like, why does hood culture even exist? Because it didn't exist in Germany, like, at all. And I missed it a lot. But I realized ultimately that it's a product of colonialism and slavery. And it led to the displacement of Black Americans in ghettos, essentially. And we were stripped of resources. And so we had to turn like nothing into something, and that the product of it was hood culture, which is like one of the leading influences of fashion and music. And so for me, I realized in Germany, like, this is really what I'm exploring and talking about. Mm-hmm. And how do I amplify the beauty of hood culture while also tying in the research and bringing up very important conversations about displacement and place-based safety, place-based identity. So had I not gone to Germany, I wouldn't have had the contrast of society there versus here. I, you know, looked at the history in Germany versus here. How did they handle, you know, the Holocaust versus how does our country handle slavery and genocide? So it really helped me hone in what my voice was and what I'm talking about and helped me be more intentional with my work.
So I think one of the central questions that came up over and over again in the exit interview series and that you talked about as well, I remember, is this idea of like, can you fulfill your dreams or your goals in Phoenix? Like, is this place big enough for it? Does it support it? What do you think now?
You know, I'm kind of on the fence about it. I think that I'm proof that it's possible. I think it just might be a little more challenging in a city like Phoenix where we lack a certain level of funding. Because let's be real, like, access to capital is like the most important thing for artists to be able to create. So I think if the city had more funding, which was something I saw in Berlin, a city government who was very supportive financially of artists, I think we'd see even more of a boom in the city. And I think there would be more opportunity for artists to be successful. So I'm never mad at someone leaving to accomplish things quicker. So yes, it is possible here. It might just be slower. It might be harder. But I feel like with the right amount of determination and discipline, you can really accomplish anything in the city.
All right. Antoinette Colley, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. The children's show Navajo Highways recently made its debut on a streaming platform called First Nations Experience. It follows a Navajo child from the city who decides she wants to spend the summer with her grandmother who lives on the Navajo Nation. Sadie, though, is a puppet, as are many of the characters on the show. Pete Sands is a filmmaker and writer from the Utah portion of the Navajo Nation. He's also the writer and director of Navajo Highways. He spoke with our co-host Mark Brody in April of last year, and they started by discussing where the idea for the series came from.
Well, I had this idea I started in 2020. I got that idea when I was out in New York Fashion Week, And I got to visit Sesame Street the same time back in 2019 and came back to the reservation to work on the COVID relief program that I started. And during that time, I ran into a lot of families who were experiencing communication difficulties with the older generation staying at home with the younger generation. The language barrier was there. And I just thought, how can I help? And I just had this experience with a teacher who was using a puppet to talk to her students. And the light went off in my head, like, hey, maybe I can use puppets to teach a language. So that's how it came. And Sesame Street was very vital and helped show me how they do things back. And it was just a combination of that.
How did you try to incorporate the influence maybe of Sesame Street while not making it just sort of a Navajo Nation version of Sesame Street?
The difference between Sesame Street and Navajo Highways is Sesame Street does not use human puppets. Everything is, they call it beastazoids. So like if you think of every puppet that's on Sesame Street, it's not a person. And Navajo Highways, what I want to do is focus on the culture, because I didn't want to use like childish voices, like, hi, my name is, you know, I wanted to use it like real people, like real voices. You know, I wanted them to make them be as real as they can, but also appealing to kids.
Yeah. Well, and interestingly, one of the main things that Sesame Street aims to do and has really from the very beginning is talk about literacy and, you know, help kids sort of learn their letters and learn their colors and learn to read, things like that. It sounds like in that sense, with the Diné language, that is very much what you're after here.
Yes, a lot of programs. I mean, you think of all the childhood programs besides Sesame Street, all the childhood programs I've watched as kids, there's always a teaching tool. There's always an educational teaching tool. And, you know, Native Americans, indigenous people have always been very creative and very artistic in the way they preserve their culture. So I just stuck with that cultural approach of using visual aid to teach language and culture.
What was the process of writing the episodes and filming it like?
Writing the episodes was a bit of a challenge because, you know, how do you balance culture and language with the show and still keep it entertaining? And as well as you got to consider that the audience is watching this, you know, just because a person's Navajo, have Navajo heritage or lineage, does not know, it doesn't mean they understand language or they have been exposed to it. So I had to keep that in mind because I was doing speeches and conferences on Navajo language and preservation for years. And I know that Navajo language at the fluency at this time is below 10% of the Navajo population. Mm. So I had to write the show to where it catered to the much greater percentage of people who weren't able to speak the language. So that balance was tough, but also how do you connect with that audience that is coming into this show not knowing much about the culture or the language? So that's why I made the main character an urban Navajo child who comes from the city, born in the city, and she wants to spend time on the reservation with her grandma. So the audience can go along with her and learn with her.
Does that make maybe the character and the content that you're trying to provide a little more relatable to viewers, do you think?
Yes, that's what I was mainly concerned with, is the audience to relate to this character. And, you know, so they don't feel like they're being taught something or being left out of the conversation. Because this is a learning tool. It's about teaching people. I mean, a lot of the folks who've watched, they understand the concept of it now. Because when I try to explain it to people, they're like, what? A puppet show about Navajo language, but they don't talk the language. But you also got to remind the audience that this is for children.
Did you find that, you know, based on sort of the fluency levels and, you know, where viewers might be starting out from, did you have to maybe think about making the lesson part of this a little more maybe rudimentary than you might have wanted to?
There's a lot of elements of what I was influenced with me when I was a child, and being able to have more than just the message of the word within the episode, because they have to learn what that word means. Like what it really resonates with them. You know, in Navajo and Diné, a word could mean five different things. Mm. So getting to the root of that word, and also learning about the culture, about the lifestyle on the reservation, what it means to live on the reservation, what does it mean to grow up in the culture? So it's more than just the language.
How do you gauge whether or not this series has the impact that you're hoping it has?
I think the reaction from the audiences, because before we even did the TV show, I used to go out and do presentation because I did small video skits from web video skits for students where they learn like how to introduce themselves in Diné. And I would take these videos and these little skits out to the elementary schools on the Navajo reservation. And the crazy amount of response I got from the kids was off the charts. I mean, just imagine like 200, 300 kids from kindergarten to third grade just screaming at the top of their lungs, you know, saying their words back to with the puppets and just enjoying it. And it's just, and people send me, like parents and grandparents send me videos of their kids watching little videos I have. And I think that's the gauge, right?
I mean, it sounds like it's already having a bit of an impact before it even comes out.
Yeah. When we did our screening in Window Rock, our premiere, our debut, I wasn't prepared for the emotional impact it would have on the older generations, because there's a lot of grandparents in the audience there, and a lot of them spoke up saying, this is what we need. This is what we're looking for, something to teach our young kids so they can look at it on TV, but they're speaking our language properly. There's a couple episodes that they feel like, you know, we do flashback scenes for some of the episodes back in the old days. So it's really, it touched them and it moved them, and it just the overwhelming outpouring of emotion and gratitude from the older generation really was really overwhelming, and I didn't expect that.
That must have been really gratifying for you.
I think it's a little validation, you know, like, yeah. You don't know if it's going to work. Like, I didn't know it was going to work. I'm just like a crazy guy with the puppet idea. I don't know if it's going to work. And then you see this reaction from people, and it also you get reactions from non-natives who watch it. And they're like, hey, you know, I got a friend who's Navajo, or I got a nephew who's Navajo, and we're trying to connect with him. And the show is going to do that for us. So like just the trailer, people saw the trailer and they were going crazy over it. They're like, this is amazing. It's gratifying, I guess is the word.
Yeah. All right. That is Pete Sands, writer and director of the new series Navajo Highways. Pete, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. At the beginning of 2025, the Navajo Nation announced a landmark agreement with a uranium mining company that's pulling the valuable mineral out of the earth near the Grand Canyon that allows them to haul it across Navajo land. They need to get the ore from the Pinyon Plain Mine to their processing plant in Blanding, Utah. And they need to go across Navajo land to do it. But when they started hauling the ore without notifying the tribal government last summer, the tribe was outraged. There are hundreds of abandoned uranium mines on Navajo land that have yet to be cleaned up, and the legacy of the industry on tribal lands still haunts these talks. The hauling agreement made in January 2025 angered activists who say the decision to allow it is a betrayal. And that includes our next guest this morning. Sabrina Manygoats is a Diné activist and artist who makes jewelry out of antique uranium glass to raise awareness about the issue. She grew up here in the Valley, not knowing about the fraught history of uranium mining that has affected generations of her family. But as she told me last February, that all changed when she was a teenager visiting her grandma on the Navajo reservation, and she saw a sign on the side of the road.
It was the summer of 2016. We were just driving down the road, the 89, and there is a new sign, very shiny, reads, radioactive contamination kills. It is time to clean up the mines. And that really just took me and my sister by surprise. And we're like rowdy teenagers. What is that? And just, it's giving me kind of like goosebumps just thinking about it.
Wow.
It's okay. Sorry.
It's okay. Take a moment.
Yeah. But just being so, oblivious to it and being so taken aback and not knowing what it truly meant and having grandma turn back and tell us the story.
What did she tell you?
she was telling us essentially, yeah, there's about 500 abandoned uranium mines and family has gotten sick. And you could tell that her demeanor shifted and she didn't want to talk about it either. And it was painful for her.
That's part of Diné culture, right? Like to not talk about misfortunes or death, things like that, because you might bring it upon yourself.
Yeah.
Do you think that's part of the reason you didn't know?
Yeah, most definitely.
What do you think about that now?
Growing up in the Valley and being exposed to different culture than family in the res, very oblivious to the fact that we were visiting the res so often, and we knew that my Nelly did not have running water, and it was just a fact of life that she would struggle, you know, during the drier months and not having water. But like to not talk that that water she could have had would be contaminated, or just thinking of the slow poisoning she was enduring, to me, it kind of, it feels like it's a battle between two worlds. The modern world where you're a modern Indigenous person, and also when you visit family, you're, you know, within the culture, within the tradition.
Yeah.
So that's what it kind of felt like. It all came to.
Did you feel guilty?
I did. I still do. I am telling people about it. And the same kind of realization comes across their face too. Like, wait, this happened? And I'm like, yep, it's currently still happening.
Mm. Yeah. And you've had family get sick, family who has gotten cancer from this, this kind of thing?
Yeah, and it, everyone on the res, honestly. Everyone's going to have a story. It's that common.
It's that common. Mm-hmm. So tell me how uranium glass came into the story here for you as an artist, right? Because you are an activist as well now. You try to educate people about these, this exact issue. But the art side of it is super interesting as well, because you use that uranium glass to make art and to make jewelry that people can wear. That seems a little ironic, maybe, is the word, right? Like wearing something that has been so harmful to the people that you come from.
Exactly. It's a piece of jewelry that someone will look at, not know the story behind it. Kind of like when you visit Monument Valley and you see this hollowed land and you just can't help but think of what goes beyond these walls, these pillars, and not knowing that that, in fact, is poisoned land as well. And something so beautiful holds something so tragic and so dark.
So when did you first come across uranium glass? It's this looks, by the way, like kind of old vases, beautiful kind of pieces of maybe Depression era glass, something like my grandmother probably had, right?
Yeah.
You found them in antique stores?
Yeah. I was quite a big antiquer. My grandma and I and my sister, we would go out and we go looking for junk.
The best.
So I think we definitely passed by a few pieces, but not knowing what it actually held. But in the pandemic, sitting at home, scrolling through TikTok, and bam, there is this piece of glass that was so contradictory, or it was like a punch in the gut. It is so, I would say, mesmerizing. It is very ethereal looking under black light, and it just gives off this glow, and it just grabs your attention immediately.
And it literally glows.
It literally glows under UV.
Wow.
And it's kind of like twinkling away, and you can't help but like look at it and be mesmerized by it. But then I don't have that opportunity to be ignorant to it, because I know what lies behind that ethereal glow.
So you started making your own artwork with it?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I saw how it captured other people's attention.
Hmm.
So knowing the power behind that and behind the story of an item and connecting it quite literally in front of people, that is the best way to have something stick in someone's mind. And that is the best way to teach a story, is to have people live it with you. And physically, it's tangible to someone.
Yeah. So tell us about the work that you make with this uranium glass. You use beads, right?
Yes, I utilize uranium glass beads, and I also pair it with traditional Navajo medicine.
Hmm.
So we have this thing called the juniper berry, and that is used in ceremony. It is used for healing. They also call it the ghost berry. For me, it ties in together perfectly because we have uranium, the ghost, that's still haunting us, and we have the healing aspect. And bringing them together is something that we can use to help go forward and teach, quite literally teach. That's all this journey has been, teaching people.
Yeah. It's okay. It's emotional for you.
It really is.
You're wearing it right now.
I know, yeah.
So how do you feel when you wear it, right? Does it feel like a reclaiming?
It does. It definitely is reclaiming.
So let me ask you about what's happening now, because as you've referred to, this is an ongoing story on the Navajo Nation. Right now, we're seeing the Navajo government just agreed to allow uranium hauling across part of the reservation from a company that's mining uranium right near the Grand Canyon. That got mixed reaction from many people, but the government essentially said, you know, I'm not sure we had any other choice. What do you think about that?
It definitely makes me feel disgusted, angry. How could we betray our tribal relatives when we have seen firsthand what has occurred? How could we do that?
They say they're taking safety measures. And the Navajo Nation government did get a lot of cleanup involved in this from that company to go clean up some of those abandoned mines you mentioned. Is that a silver lining for you?
It is not. It feels like we need to finish what we started, which is cleaning up those mines. We can't move forward from such an exploitative thing that happened to us. We can't move forward unless we fix it entirely.
So what message do you want to send with the work that you're doing at the moment that you're doing it, right? In which this is still so contentious, still happening. People are still very upset about it. What do you want people to know?
I want people to keep it in the forefront of conversations. That's also the idea behind the jewelry. Just keeping the conversation alive. Because the moment we forget about what has happened previously with our elders and our sickness, that's the moment that we're just going to continue exploiting the land and continue poisoning the land and poisoning ourselves.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Sabrina Manygoats joining us to talk about her work. Thank you so much, Sabrina. I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening to the show. Don't forget you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radio Heads, at theshow.kjzz.org. And you can follow us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.
The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.